The reason why we invited all of you is pretty much about, like, we would like to pick, if not to say steal, your brains in a way. Because, I mean, we are not, how to say, media theory people, so we probably misuse words and phrases and technical terms a lot, and we even invent new ones, and we probably misinterpret, like, the words and phrases you're going to use while your talks, and I think that's one of the reasons we invited you.
And what's the main reason to steal your ideas? With the best of intentions, misuse them. And we're basically going through this process of the things that we've been doing and working out ways of making them better, whatever that means. So we thought we'd just spend a few minutes now trying to explain sort of where we've come from and where we think that our work sort of fits into this collage of things that is this data ecologies and future fabulators.
Yeah, so as Tim said, before we dive into all sorts of futures, we might go a few steps back in our history. Because, I mean, we have this history on our shoulders, and that's probably the reason why we ended up where we sort of end up or where we are right now. And these, as we call them, early works, probably could be seen with this very strong concentration on the physicality, could be seen as a reaction to the 1990s virtuality madness. So somehow we have been, I mean, not necessarily bored by it, but it was a bit too virtual for us, so we invented the word virtual reality, which is actually a book right now. You have got to find the book title on it.
There's a book called Real Virtuality that just came out recently.
Yeah.
They stole our name.
So we started around 96, and that, like, this sort of early works were probably running till 2004, 2005. As we said already, very much concentrated on physicality. So it was very important for us to set up whole environments which have been explorable, and so people have been able to interact with on a very basic, sort of even bodily active level. And so we had all this interface design, which, I mean, one of the things we wanted to always have, that these interfaces are very intuitive, so people easily know how they can handle them. So, like, bicycle, we had bicycles and swings and all sort of, intuitive interfaces. And so we encouraged, actually, an audience, or it was important for us to encourage an audience to use these interfaces to change the whole audio-visual environment around them. And so it was, for us, we always saw ourselves probably much more as a facilitator than artists or designers or whatever. So we have been facilitating this audiovisual environments changed through the audience, and then we have been these ones observing an audience playing with our spaces. So that was always very nice to see. And if someone once probably, I mean, these early walks, works could be referred to as media art. We don't know. It's up to somebody else defining it.
So one of the things that we found very quickly is that we didn't really want to speak about an audience. An audience seemed to be a very sort of problematic term, because it essentially means a listener, or a spectator is someone who looks. And we wanted to have the idea of what we were doing and wanted to do was to involve people, to actually get them to be actively involved in a situation. And so we think of them as visitors. They're visiting this place that we've built, and they're doing something in there. And in particular, this whole idea of a proto-scientist was raised by an anthropologist friend of ours, who regarded what people were doing was exploring these spaces as some sort of proto-scientific confrontation with the environment, trying to work out what was going on, what were the regularities, how was it similar to but still different from normal reality, sort of everyday life. And also to speak very much about the environments, not just as a collection of objects, but actually a complete situation where things locked together and became a complete world. So, for instance, Gravitron is a, basically it's six people standing on giant force feedback joysticks. So they've got pneumatics on them, and you use your whole body to rock these joysticks. And then create an emergent sort of properties, emergent movement in this mesh here. Some models of it were as like a pond filled with some sort of weird bacteria. Other ways of thinking about it were as like waves of gravity going through space, tearing up space and making little objects out of them and things. And so it was very much inviting people to come and explore the possibilities in these environments that we'd built and to see what could be done. There was also the expression for gravitron that came out, but also things like this with this, unfortunately the picture's very dark. They're actually standing on a disc, which is at a slight angle. So as soon as you walk away from the bottom, it turns. And so you can just keep on running on this disc. And it's sort of like children's playground equipment that we took and broke in interesting ways, attached a whole bunch of extra media to it, and got people to sort of explore and play with. What was really interesting is that this hardware, because it's very sort of playful hardware, functioned as a sort of social glue. It enabled people to communicate, so we could talk about it in the way that social software has been talked about for the past decade, as social hardware, as ways that people are forced to react with one another through these hardware interfaces, and to sort of explore things that are going on there. Also want to talk about, just going back to this one, the distraction properties. This is actually at a festival that was on the way to a bar. People would go through this space looking for a beer, very goal-oriented, and then once they got their beer and they left, as they came out, they realized that the entire floor was reacting to how they were walking through. And so getting away from goal-oriented behavior, more sort of playful exploration, was a very important part of what we were doing with these interfaces. Carry Resonator is a giant karaoke machine. As we know, everyone likes a karaoke machine. We've also been quite horrified and thrilled and alarmed at the sounds that people were able to make with these devices. They were, in some sense, musical playthings, sound, acoustic playthings, and people would manage to create the most strange assemblages of noise and grunts and dinosaur tones. We're not quite sure who this pleasant young man is here who's howling, but we think he was having a good time. Yes, and this is swings. Everyone loves a swing. It's amazing how, as soon as you give grown-ups an excuse to act like children, they will quite happily dive into things and get very excited by them. And luckily here it wasn't the case, but in other places they were able to swing high enough to kick the panels out of the ceiling like we have here. People just seem to really like exploring, I don't know, urban exploring on the inside of a space, something like that.
Right, and as Tim already started to say, it was much more locking these separated interface groups together to sort of establish actually a whole environment. People have been able to spend quite a while in there. So with most of these installations, we decided that it would be good to have a space somewhere placed where people could actually meet and chat and have a drink. So this sort of surrounding environments where people have been able to relax and talk to each other and even find out maybe what they haven't seen yet, because a few parts of the playground, if you want to call it a playground, have been maybe a bit too hidden or you have been rushing through. So we tried to make sure that these spots where you even have been, for example, hustled by a robot asking you for money that he can have a beer, or where you were just able to hang around, that you can actually go back to the playground again and find these bits which you either haven't seen or you just wanted to figure out how they really worked. Because it was quite interesting listening to the people there and sort of getting these ideas they had about the functionality about the stuff we built. And most of these explanations have been much more complex than the work we did. So that was quite interesting actually to listen to. So I think that was enough about our early works.
Because this whole thing was about building worlds, sort of physical worlds in a way that people could come and explore. And we very consciously avoided any idea of psychology. We didn't think we understood what people were doing. We didn't understand their belief systems or how they thought the system was working. It was all behaviorist in some way. And after a while, we got interested in some other projects that we'd like to do and became more interested in actually the stories that people were telling about the spaces and the stories that they could create around a space. And so we started doing some pieces and started to talk about the idea of a physical narrative. So in the same way that we were inviting people in to explore these strange media-enriched semi-normal worlds, we now invite them to come interact with a space that had a story in it. And this is a stolen idea from the book Snoop, but the idea being that if I was to come into your office or your lounge room, but offices are very good for this, and you had to leave quickly and said, look, I need to do something, I'll be back in 10 minutes, make yourself at home. If I was extremely polite, I would hold my hands behind my back and stare out your window and wouldn't see anything. Most normal people will browse each other's bookshelves because this is a relatively civilized thing to do. And by doing this, I would begin to understand some of the books that you're interested in. I'd see that there were some open books lying on a coffee table. I might get an idea that you've got a strong addiction to, I don't know, China medieval books, or you really like Jules Verne or something, which maybe would say something about your enthusiasm about maritime activities, whatever. I could work out a bit of your story. If I was a bit ruder, I might notice that there was a torn up love letter on your desk, or some half-drunken glasses of red wine in the corner. And piece by piece, I could put together in some sort of pseudo-detective or proto-detective way an idea of the story of what was happening in your life. And this is what we think about in terms of a physical narrative, a space that we construct that has a story embedded in it, and we invite an audience to come in and explore it. So it's very much about these aspects. Do you want to do these or do you want to do these?
Just keep going if there is anything to say, because I would come up with the core characteristics, because it was necessary for us to sort of define some core characteristics of a physical narrative. Even for us, it was important to know what we have to run through or tick on our list, that it's really a physical narrative. So, and very obvious, it needs to be physical. So it needs to be placed in an existing space, and there need to be material objects, and an audience really has to interact with these objects. They even can be media enhanced, but still, it needs to be real, it needs to be physical. I mean, again, very important for us was that these spaces are explorable and they are interactive. So it's not, it needs to be more than a surface. So we really wanted to invite, again, an audience to search through these spaces. And then that's when the psychology comes in. All of a sudden, we have been interested in people's life. So they have to be character-based. They should be character-based, either one character or a whole group of people living in these spaces. I mean, they are not present in the moment you, as an audience, enter these spaces, but still you can find their traces. And these stories, like physical narratives, are authored. So it's a group of people deciding what story should be told, and this story is the one which you can find within the physical world. So it's not just a world compared to these audiovisual environments we have built, but it's a world with inhabitants which you can find. And it's mechanical, and that pretty much only means it's not a theater. We don't have got actors, like living actors, in these spaces. But again, you find the traces of them. And yeah, it's narrative. I mean, there is a story told which is separate from the audience looking through the narrative. So it's the story is told through the space, but it's not played out through the space. Sort of. Anything?
We went through these ideas more or less to try and work out what was the difference between what we were trying to do and what we thought we were doing, and try and distinguish it from other whole bunch of related fields. So more or less, if you take any of these properties and remove them, you get something else that is quite different. For instance, by adding actors, you actually end up with a space like a Sleep No More performance, which is filled with actors running around actually doing a piece of theatre. So we sort of wanted to work out where we were sitting on all of these various continuums to see how they fitted together. So maybe, excuse me, one of the very early pieces we did together with Alex Davies was Domestic Bliss. This was done in an old apartment building here in Linz, and the building had been abandoned, and we basically reinstated a flat. There was an entrance, like a kitchen, a bathroom, which you can see in here, and there was a bedroom. And in the bedroom, there was another door that went on, but it was blocked by a cupboard. And as you went in there, a story began to get told. On the television in the corner of the bedroom, a woman came on screen who was over a CCTV camera, which you could see through the gap in the door in the next room, to tell you a story of what had happened in this environment. And as she told the story, which she was telling you from behind this cupboard, the story began to happen around you. So firstly, the radio came on and played music that was relevant, and there was some CCTV footage of the murder. Of course, in 1956, there was no CCTV, but it's theater, suspension of disbelief. And slowly, the storm that she was referring to happened around you, and then all of a sudden, the murderer that she's telling you about appears behind her. You see her be attacked, and he starts shaking this cupboard, trying to escape into the space that you're in. So the piece was very much about messing with ideas of causality and time, about dragging you into this world, and worked to this degree that people, when this cupboard shaked, a few people actually screamed and ran out of the flat, which we found somewhat strange to believe that this sort of worked. People asked each other, oh, just shit, I've forgotten my umbrella. Where is my umbrella? It was a beautiful sunny day and there was no chance of rain, but the immersion of this weather happening around the environment was very convincing. But what was most convincing somehow, and the most important part, was the everyday life, which you can't see here because it's a remarkably dark photo, of just the detritus of life. There was a typewriter, there were martini glasses, there was dishes and a straight razor. Just the effects of it being, in some sense, a very normal part of life.
Stored in a Bank Vault was another physical narrative we did, and that was actually, it was the planning of a bank robbery. So it was pretty much the setup of a heist, like four people working and living in several rooms. I think all of the times we had around 3 to 4 rooms where it was spread out. And as an audience member, you would walk in there, and very obviously you got this information that there is a bank robbery in planning, but then you found out, okay, well, there are apparently some people living in here as well, because there was sort of a mobile kitchen area, then there have been sleeping rooms. You at least have been able to listen to the bathroom behind a locked door, and somebody was talking in there, taking a bath. So the more time, and I think that's sort of a general idea within the physical narratives, it's depending on the time people do spend within these rooms. I mean, there should be always a first impression, which is making clear what the basic story or the basic story arc would be about. But then the longer time you spend with this physical narrative, the more fragments of the story you get, the more information or sort of little parts you get, which you can then puzzle together and sort of make up your even own story about it, which is certainly led through whatever we put in there, because everything put in, everything placed there is on purpose, so it is staged. But still, it's about you, how I do connect all these threads and fragments I find. So, yeah. So you had all these diagrams and maps and schedules, so how who needs to be distracted at what time that we can enter this door. So yeah, all sorts of things, and then you realize that it's actually not about money. So this twists and surprises in between, or sort of yeah, the longer you stay there. We had this person, botanist, who was part of the crew as well, and apparently he was a very important one because he actually knows everything about these seeds, and it's about the seeds. So it's not money; it's seeds which need to be taken from the bank. And yep, just in general and to the quick, the surprises which then through you staying longer inside you get.
Further into them and get lost in these sort of distractions and contradictions. Like a good book that hooks you at the end with a surprising twist, we tried to do this with Stored in a Bank Vault. On the other hand, we had a very non-twistiness with 20 Seconds into the Future. This is perhaps the most science fiction piece that we've done. It was based on some very normal mathematics and physics, and then a little bit of fringe mathematics, and then we took it off in a vaguely science fiction direction. And it was part of a long night of research. So people sort of arrived there expecting to have a scientist explain something about his research projects and what they were doing. He was missing, and it became apparent after a while that he was in the next room, stuck in his time machine, disappearing into tomorrow. And you were there sort of to explore his office and find out all the dirty secrets, like the bottom drawer filled with cheap science fiction videos, as sort of an insider look into what physicists really do. But there was a lot more sort of background. There were motivations. Why is he doing this? What's he interested in? Where does he come from? Because a lot of science communication is very banal, and it's all about, oh, I'm going to cure cancer. But that might not be the real reason. The real reason is that someone's dog was very sick when they were a kid and they wanted to become medically involved. So we tried to talk about motivations and inspirations, but also fill the space with lots of ridiculous technology. So there's actually burnt bits of time travel experiments hanging on the wall, or lots of LED numbers running to see how many microseconds into the future our scientist has disappeared. To try and explain this, sort of make it all very science fiction and fun, but to make it very immersive, there was a constant stream of messages coming into the space. So there were faxes arriving, there was an answering machine that kept on turning on, and people were leaving messages to explain a lot about the story. So the longer you spent there, the more little elements of the story were introduced to you, and whether it was like little pop-ups that gave you the first two lines of an email. And bit by bit, people were drawn into this story, and a lot of people turned up, expected a presentation from a scientist, and left because he wasn't going to turn up. But other people were very excited and spent tens of minutes, I think even like over an hour, a couple of people spent diving into this world of this scientist and where he was going so into the future.
Unattended luggage is another one, and probably the most compact physical narrative we did so far. It's really placed within this ancient suitcase, and it's a family saga. And we have got actually packed in there four generations and five family members, and it's this suitcase with these little drawers and compartments and little shelves, and people have been able to search through these drawers, or sort of have been invited at least to search through there to find personal belongings and get even like an idea of the relations in between the family members and how they are connected and who was actually migrating to where at what time. So even the professional careers have been there. So it's like 100 years in a suitcase, meaning that there has been lots of media-enhanced material, like there was an audio recording, like an audio diary from one of the family members, and she was traveling the world, I think, for many, many years, like 15 years. So you have been able to listen through her diary, then you had an answering machine again, where you had the chance to get some communication in between at least those two family members still alive and still talking to each other. So again, in the very first moment, people have been able to realize, okay, well, apparently it has to do with migration, it has to do with escape willingly or unwillingly. But then again, if you spend more time, you even find sort of very personal notes and sort of wedding images, and then the immigration passport from the very first family member in the early 30s from Austria to the United States to New York. So again, the more time you spend, the more you get, but still this importance on first impression should already tell you something at least. So people shouldn't walk away not knowing what they just saw.
And lots of everydayness. Love letters, razors, those lots of lovely little bits and pieces. One of the important pieces here was a radio that had three channels, one of them being the 1930s music, another one 1930s politics, so a collection of like essentially the 1930s, I think, to 1942 or something, all run together. Another one, the boxing match between Max Schelling and, who was it, Andy? Joe Louis, which is an incredibly important part of this sort of Germany, America sort of thing that was happening in the 30s. So trying to mix this everyday life and little features, little bits that enable you to get in there. Ooh, that's a different picture than the one I had before.
Actually, sorry, I changed it in the morning.
Show anything. Oh, it looks really good on the screen here anyway, so sorry that project. We need to get a 17,000 lumen projector, I think, in here. Just as a slight tangent, one of the reasons we started getting involved in these more physical narrative-based things rather than these media environments was after about 10 years of spending your time in a room that's at least as dark as this or much darker, to have all the projections working that are as isolated from sound so that you've got all your sound installations working properly, and you spend all bad food. The expression art jail was raised, and for this, and we decided that escaping art jail and actually having physical existence and light and good food and things was actually an important thing to do. One of the very simple motivations for getting out of media art, probably. Which brings us to the future. Future Fabulators was the project we developed in collaboration with our partners and are still developing. Was very much about trying to take these models of possible futures, future scenarios, develop these scenarios and bring them down to very everyday life examples, ways that things might be for people in the future. And so these physical narratives seem to us to be a really interesting way of being able to explore them and to allow a certain freedom of exploration for people who want to look at this stuff. They can get a very superficial first view idea, but they can also dive down into more and more detail about this, the depth that you can have in a scenario, which is very hard to do in something like a video where you've got a certain framework. So the reason that we dragged you here was to listen to us explain all this sort of stuff and then to see the ways that we think that our work interrelates to the work that you're doing in all the different ways, and to try and find ways that we can steal ideas from each other.
That's it. No, nothing to say anymore. I mean, it's exactly open up.
Yes, that's all the things we wanted to say on our magic list. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you.